My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
To another episode of My Classic Album, looking back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and a fun episode today, one that I've been looking forward to, and I know that many of you have been looking forward to it too. So when I announced this episode on our social media pages, there was a huge explosion of interest, a huge explosion of excitement, not only for the album that we're talking about today, but indeed the guests. And that's right, I did say guests, because for the first time in My Classic Album history, we're not just talking to one person about their love of a classic album, we're talking to three. In fact, a family, a whole family of sisters. Mexico's hottest rising band, The Warning, are going to be joining me in just a few minutes to chat about their chosen classic album, My Chemical Romance's third album, The Black Parade. So there's quite a few firsts that we're doing here, as I'd alluded to there. You know, this is the first time that we're having more than one guest talking about their classic album. So we do have all three members of the band. We have Ali, Danny and Pau talking about their love for this album. That's the first time we've done that. Today's episode, at the time of recording, holds the distinction for having the episode with the most recent classic album on it. So this is very much a modern classic. You know, a lot of the albums we do on My Classic Album, we're talking about the 70s, the 80s, the 90s to an extent. This is one of three albums that we've done so far that are from this side of the millennium. So, you know, if you do have more modern tastes, we've got an episode dedicated to Arctic Monkeys, Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not, way back in episode 10. And then last year, during season 3, we looked at Blink-182's self-titled album from 2005. The Black Parade holds the distinction that it's a newer album than both of those. Just, I think it's only by a few months or a few weeks, but it makes it our most recent classic album that we've done in nearly 6 years of doing this podcast. So it's an interesting conversation because it's not just about what makes this album great, but it's about kind of why it's going to stand the test of time, why it's going to live up to the hype of some of the other kinds of classic albums that we talk about on the show. So a really interesting chat, really looking forward to hearing my conversation with the girls from The Warning, and it'll be coming up in just a few minutes' time. If you haven't already, check out the first episode of season 4 that came out just last week, where Troy Redfern joined me to chat all about Frank Zappa's three-act rock opera that is Joe's Garage. So obviously The Black Parade is a rock opera as well, albeit very different to The Black Parade, but you know, if you're a Frank Zappa fan, you can go back and listen to my chat with Troy Redfern. That's online now, in all the usual places, wherever you listen to your podcasts, and over at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. Fast forward a week's time, and we're going to be joined by Jack J. Hutchinson to talk about a guy who is in the news quite a bit at the moment. So we're going to be looking at Neil Young's third album, After the Gold Rush. Obviously, Neil is very much in the news at the moment for pulling his music off Spotify. The likes of Joni Mitchell have kind of followed him in doing that. At my chat with Jack J. Hutchinson, who chose the album, was recorded before Neil was in the news, so there's not much conversation about that, but what it is a great conversation about a fantastic album. So if you like Neil Young, again, in just a week's time, we're going to be chatting all about After the Gold Rush. And then fast forward 2 weeks from there, that'll be all we'll have for February. The start of March, we're going to be looking at a band, one of my favourite bands. I love Toto so much. I've really got a soft spot for Toto, and I always have. And Lizzie Hayes from The Hot Damn will be joining me on the 1st of March to chat all about arguably their most celebrated album, Toto 4. So in terms of Toto, if you've heard Africa, if you've heard Rosanna, both of those songs are on the album. But, you know, it's not just a two-song album. It's just phenomenal from start to finish, with the kind of quality you would expect from Toto. So some great episodes coming up over the next few weeks. And, you know, if you want to keep up with My Classic Album, if you want to know what's going on, you want to know what guests are coming on the show, you want to know what albums we're going to be covering, myclassicalbum.co.uk is kind of the hub for all of that. Every episode, right from the beginning, is up there. But the social media channels are probably the first place that you could find out the latest gen in terms of what's going on with My Classic Album. So if you get yourself to Facebook and search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris and like the page, over on Instagram, you search for at My Classic Album Podcast, and then, of course, over on Twitter, at MCA underscore podcast, for all the latest announcements around My Classic Album. And I've got some great guests lined up and some great people I'm talking to. They're all choosing great albums. Absolutely, keep it at myclassicalbum.co.uk. Make sure you're subscribing to the podcast as well, so you never miss an episode. And there is a contact section on the website as well. So feel free to drop me a message. Let me know what you think of the podcast. What albums do you want to see covered? Are there any guests that you'd like to see appear on the show? You know, I'm always open to chatting with people, and I read all the messages myself. So absolutely make sure that you get in touch. But I know how excited people are for my chat with Ali, Danny and Pau of The Warning. So let's just get down to it. They are my special guests today, chatting about an album that's heavily inspired them, My Chemical Romance's The Black Parade. But before we dive in to my chat with the girls, let's just have a look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about The Black Parade. October 20th, 2006 saw the release of The Black Parade, the third studio album from American rockers My Chemical Romance. Recorded throughout 2006, the band and producer Rob Cavallo took residence at the Paramore Mansion in California, which was said to be haunted. Paranormal activity witnessed by the band helped set the tone for the rock opera which would become The Black Parade, a story which chronicled the death and afterlife of its titular character, The Patient. The first single, Welcome to the Black Parade, signalled My Chemical Romance's intent with the album, topping the singles chart in September 2006. The single saw strong success in the US too, reaching number 9. Famous Last Words continued the momentum for The Black Parade, reaching number 8 in the UK and number 88 in the US. With the album performing so well in the UK, a third single, I Don't Love You, gave the band another top 20 hit, reaching number 13, while Teenagers solidified the album's success on both sides of the pond, reaching number 9 in the UK and number 67 in the US. With a string of successful singles, The Black Parade exploded onto the album charts across the world, reaching number 2 in both the US and the UK. The Black Parade also performed well in the likes of Canada, Australia, Germany, even reaching number 1 in New Zealand. The album has also achieved triple platinum status in the US as well as the UK. The Black Parade was instantly lauded as a classic album, and its esteem continues to grow as the years pass. Kerrang! Named The Black Parade second in the 50 best rock albums of the 2000s in 2016, while Rolling Stone named The Black Parade amongst its 500 best albums of all time in 2020, ranking it number 361. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about The Black Parade. And I have here with me my very special guests who chose this album to talk about today on My Classic Album. We have The Warning. How's it going, guys?
Hey! Great to be here.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
Yeah, this is great for me because I think this is actually, it's the first time, obviously we've been doing this podcast for a while, it's the first time that we've had more than one guest at a time. So obviously, just so everyone knows, we've got the entire band here who've chosen this album. So
is it three of us?
Yes. Hi, I'm Danny.
I'm Pau.
And I'm Ali.
And again, I found this really cool that not only that we've got all three of you on, but that you've all agreed on one classic album. So why why have you chosen The Black Parade to talk about on My Classic Album today?
Okay, so I'm Pau. And when I was in middle school, I was in like seventh grade, I think, I went through like an emo phase. But The Black Parade, for me, was my album. Like, I listened to it on repeat all the time, and I would constantly show it to my sisters, who are Danny and Ellie.
So we copied her.
they loved the album as well, and it just kind of became, like, this very emblematic album for us and for our sound and, like, for our band.
Yeah, it was a very big inspiration to our sound in general. And also, Pau, like, you became really obsessed with the band, and also I think we have all their
I bought all of their LPs. Like, I have all of their vinyls, all of their albums on vinyl. I became like really obsessed with My Chemical Romance. But The Black Parade also really inspired me. in my way of writing, like in concept albums and stuff like that. It was, I think, my first concept album that I had ever heard. So I became really obsessed with telling stories with songs after listening to this album. After listening to The Black Parade, we made our second album called Queen of the Murder Scene, which was heavily inspired by The Black Parade.
And I think, obviously, as we go into this, we'll talk about, as you say, albums that were inspired by it, but in turn, a lot of albums that the band were inspired by when they were recording The Black Parade as well. And I think, I mean, for you particularly, Pau, what were your memories the first time you put this on? What was that like for you?
Oh, okay. So I remember that I only knew Welcome to the Black Parade. That was the only song I knew from the album. And I really liked it. It was on one of my Spotify playlists. And I was like, okay, I like this song. And I just got like kind of this curiosity, like, if the song is that good, why don't I listen to the whole album? Because also, I feel like there's a very big generational gap with listening to albums. My generation doesn't do that much anymore. So I sat down, I was doing my homework, and I listened to the whole album. And I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. It was just like
so epic,
so good. And the storytelling was very clear, and I just really fell in love with it.
And then, of course, at that point, it sounds like that kind of love for the album, that's kind of bled into kind of the other two of you as well, to the point where it's really inspired the Warnings music. And like you say, that previous album you released just a couple of years ago, heavily influenced by the album we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, no, it really inspired all of us. At one point, I think I answered the question of like, if you were stuck on a deserted island with only one album, which one would you pick? I was just like, the Black Parade.
And I feel like it really inspired us storytelling wise and like how much you can tell of a story in one song.
Absolutely. Now, to go back, so it was 2006 this album came out. When I worked out, we've done a few albums this side of Millennium on My Classic Album. This is probably the most recent album we've done, which I think is really cool.
Oh my god, recent? I mean, I was 4.
I was 2 when this came out.
That's yeah. Amazing. So 2006 for us, that's a really long time ago.
But I think what's cool about that, though, is obviously we do so many albums from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, this kind of thing. But we're getting to a point now, obviously, as we go into the 2020s, you know, what were the classic albums of the noughties, of the tens? And that's why I think it's really cool when we do an album that, at least for me, like I remember the album coming out, I was 20. So that gives you the idea of the age gap. You know, like I think it's really cool when we do these albums, because again, it's thinking about what are these future classics? What's going to be held up there with the likes of some of these other albums that we're going to be talking about today that were inspired by them. So right. I think it's going to be a lot of fun to dive into this. But in 2006, My Chemical Romance, they were certainly one of the biggest bands in rock at that point already when they were writing and recording The Black Parade. They'd just come off the back of 2004's Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge, which...
Good album as well, yes.
And I believe that was my first exposure to My Chemical Romance at the time. Mm-hmm. What I know you'd said you've got all the My Chemical Romance.
Oh, yeah,
Romance.
I got all of them.
Well, I mean, what are your thoughts on that album? How does it compare to what we hear on The Black Parade?
Ooh, so I feel like The Black Parade is like a more polished version
of My Chemical Romance.
Three Cheers, but I love Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge so much. It's also a concept album.
It's a lot more like chaotic, if I
yes
it like
is
that.
It is,
yeah,
but I think they're very different. But I do feel like The Black Parade is just like a more polished version of storytelling and sound.
And I think it's interesting, you know, obviously I'll share some kind of perspective from Gerard Way and other members of the band as we go on, reflecting on kind of those early My Chem albums. Gerard told Travis Mills, he said, I knew what I wanted the first record to sound like. Basically, the idea was to keep progressing more and more as the album kept going. But I felt like this really big kind of bombastic theatricality in the music as well started to emerge sometime after Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge. So it sounds to me like there's been, as you say, you know, maybe Black Parade's a little more polished. There's this deliberate evolution, isn't there, in their sound from their debut, I Brought You My Bullets, You Brought Me Your Love, right through to where we are by the third album, which is, of course, The Black Parade.
Yeah, no. It definitely continues that kind of like same, I think, feeling, but and it's just like a little bit more,
but theatrical is really a good word for it. Yeah. It is, like, it feels like you can feel the story very clearly. And after The Black Parade, when they released what is it called, Danger Days,
yeah,
it feels even more theatrical. So I feel like they got really deep into their storytelling and their characters within, like, as they kept releasing more music.
So as you'd said, The Black Parade, it is a concept album, a rock opera, some people would love to call it. Chronicling the journey of a character known as the Patient. So the etching includes his death and his time in the afterlife. So again, in that same interview I was just referencing there, Gerard told Mills, "We had wanted to make kind of an important record about death. There wasn't a lot of bands or music, at least in mainstream or popular culture, that were kind of talking about these things." I mean, do you think there's some truth to that? Death's a subject. We seem to avoid talking about it anyway, much less write whole albums about it. Do you think it stands out? Because it is, obviously, death is a huge theme on this album. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. I feel like it was
so exciting.
When I started researching like the story of the Black Parade when I was in middle school, first of all, I felt really angsty and edgy, so it felt very middle school to me. But also, like, it was very interesting to hear other people's perspectives on what could happen after death and what certain experiences that this character lived through when they were alive. And also, death, I feel like culturally, is also very different. Because here, like, we Mexicans have a whole holiday based on death. So to hear it in the perspective of different people and different cultures and hear it like just put into a story in an album is just a really cool journey of like some thoughts that these writers may have had.
And it is interesting to think of it from that cultural perspective, isn't it? Because like I say, obviously here in the UK, you know, death, it's you know, it's something that we tiptoe around. We don't talk about it. You know, it's it's kind of the elephant in the room. Like you say, for yourself in your culture, there's a whole holiday kind of celebrating it and kind of what happens after that.
Like for us, like Day of the Dead is like this holiday where we remember our loved ones and we basically make a connection on this day with the dead and we celebrate their lives. So we celebrate a life after death in like memory. That's what the whole holiday is about. So I feel like this album also makes this connection on like how your memories and how your legacy continues living on even after you die. And I just felt like that was a really comforting like topic. Like even after you're gone, you still leave something behind. So I feel like that's a very big message in this album in general.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think part of it is, like I said, that sounds like a morbid premise. And I think obviously we'll talk a little bit about people's attitudes to the band, certainly in the UK, possibly before this album came out, in a little bit. But I think it's, for me, it sounds like a morbid premise, but it is. It's an album filled with so much hope. I think you've summed it up really nicely. I think Gerard said the following about the album and the song, The March of the Black Parade, which of course we'll get to. And I think this sums it up really nicely. So he said, "The triumph of the human spirit over darkness was something that was kind of built into the DNA of the band from the beginning. The self-actualization, the triumph of the spirit and things like that, getting through really hard things. There's darkness in the world. And I think overcoming that darkness externally and internally is a beautiful thing. It's a challenging thing, but it's beautiful if you can do that, if you can kind of triumph over that." So that's a theme that's definitely in Black Parade, the song, and it's in my work. And I think that's absolutely tying in with what you're saying, just the hope on this album, which you wouldn't necessarily expect when you hear that it's about a cancer patient who's dying and his journey into the afterlife.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, but I feel like that sums it up perfectly. Because you start the album, like it starts with The End. That's the first song. And it starts pretty morbid and it's pretty dark and sad. But in the last song, Famous Last Words, you end up with such a hopeful tone that even like you can repent and you can start doing good things and you can change as a person and that can change your legacy. Like that is such a positive ending, you know, and it just leaves you like really hopeful for life in general.
Yeah, absolutely. Interestingly, when they produced this album, so a little bit of it was done kind of as they were winding up their tour, the Revenge tour in 2005, but the majority of it was recorded on an estate in California known as the Paramore Mansion. Now, Papa Roach, amongst others, had also recorded there. Many stories have come out of the Black Parade sessions that the Paramore was haunted. So, so members report hearing doors slam. Gerard started having really vivid nightmares. He told the New York Times there was a lot of fire, stuff like Joan of Arc and Brimstone and Damnation, or people that I really love were dead and I'd get the phone call. His brother, Mikey, was struggling quite severely with his mental health, had an anxiety-induced breakdown. That caused him to temporarily leave the band, and that's very present within some of the lyrics and in the song. It's really creepy stuff, but I feel like that, I mean, from what you were saying there, was that something that you weren't aware of? Does that change your kind of feelings on the album in some way in terms of how you interpret it?
I didn't know that they went through. I knew that Mikey had that anxiety thing. It definitely translates in, like, I remember the members talking about how it translates into some of the songs, but I didn't know about the whole haunted studio thing. Yeah, like, imagine that.
No. Yeah, though.
Being in the studio is sometimes really stressful, and I can't imagine.
On top of that.
Ooh. I cannot help but think about the song, like, Sleep. It makes so much sense now. Like, I don't know. It's just like, wow. Yeah.
That's insane.
Wow.
It's interesting you should link Sleep, because you're absolutely right. You know, we'll talk about that much more, but that's certainly, obviously, the mansion played a big part in that song. And I think, you know, I think about, so I'm sure it was Blood Sugar Sex Magic by the Red Hot Chili Peppers. That was recorded in a mansion that again was haunted, but their kind of feelings on it were very different to what was happening here, in that, you know, again, it sounds like it really, from what I can gather, obviously, it sounds like there's elements of those sessions that the band don't like to talk about because of kind of the nature of what happened in that house.
Oh, wow. That must be really tough.
Yeah, that must be very intense. Yeah. Especially since they have to live with this album for like the rest of their lives.
Yeah, that's insane.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely. I mean, Gerard, he has spoke about it. He was on the podcast My Turning Point, and he said, we were just in this haunted house together, kind of becoming slowly depressed and withdrawn, isolated from the world outside. I don't remember us even leaving the house. It became a dark place, and just being in there and kind of jamming this idea together and playing it together. But as you've said, songs like Sleep and there's some other ones on the album, you know, obviously they all tie into a story, which we're going to talk about at length, but very much about the experience that they had here in this mansion. So, you know, really crazy stuff.
Oh my God.
That is really crazy.
That is so good. Wow. I want to give them a hug.
Yeah,
that
was a big
So, you know, My Chemical Romance, they've been a huge part of the emo scene up to now. The Black Parade marks the band embracing the likes of, you know, I'd said that this being a podcast where we normally tackle much kind of, for lack of a better term, older albums. You know, bands like Queen, Pink Floyd, David Bowie, really strong influences here on the Black Parade. This did lead to a backlash of sorts from corners of their hardcore fan base. So Far Out magazine explained that the long-term MCR fans who hated the record as they saw it as the band selling out were either wrong or misguided, as it was an augmentation of the band's old sound. There were still elements of hardcore, emo, and alternative rock, but the band expertly fused it with other ingredients, including soft rock and glam. In the process, they took their career to the next level. I mean, why do you think, obviously, like you say, we've talked about this evolution across the albums and such. Why do you think that maybe some of their longtime fans had issue with this album? Why do you think that they kind of accused them of selling out?
Okay. So I remember when I got really into it, I would hear about that. And I was like, why? Like, this is my favorite album. But I can imagine coming from you, like the first album and then their second album, Three Cheers, and then jumping to the Black Parade. The Black Parade does sound more polished, like more produced, and like Three Cheers sounds a bit more like a rough and like grungy and like really raw, if that makes any sense. So people sometimes associate like polished and like evolution with selling out, as of like, oh, like they're not themselves anymore or stuff like that. But I feel like changing and growing, it's such a big part of being a musician that whenever I see other artists do stuff like this, it's just like, okay, it's cool. Like, you're stepping into a new era of these people and they're sharing it with you through their music.
Yeah. And I think their previous fan base connected to the way their music was so spontaneous and so like raw, and that feeling that when they came with this, it's a lot deeper. It's a whole storyline. You have to connect it. Like, you have to like process it more to like get super into every song, that's where they went like through a different path, and they just like, I don't know. Well, I think that's
spooked.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because again, obviously, we're talking about it being a concept album, being a rock opera, and I think that was something, obviously, again, in the 70s, that they were commonplace. They were all over the place. In 2006, there weren't many bands who were releasing a rock opera.
Definitely not.
You know what I mean? And I guess for me, obviously, that's a gamble that paid off, because we're sitting here 16 years later talking about it. You know what I mean? So there's obviously
16 years later. I cannot believe that number. No, but it makes sense, because when I got into it, they were celebrating 10 years of the Black Parade.
Yeah,
I can't believe that. That's insane.
And I mean, even the fact that they're celebrating those anniversaries. So, like, let's listen to some of these albums I've got written down here. So, A Night at the Opera by Queen, The Wall by Pink Floyd, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by The Beatles, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust by David Bowie. These are all albums that the Black Parade gets compared to, or people notice a little bit of an influence in, a bit of inspiration. You know, obviously, we're talking about this album, as we say, 16 years on. Do you believe this album kind of lives up? I mean, again, they're really kind of undisputed classic albums we're talking about. Do you think that, you know, as time goes on, that we'll be talking about the Black Parade in kind of the same circles?
I do believe.
I feel like it changed. Like, it was a very big album, and it changed, like, so, like, just for my generation, for me, that it is an equivalent to those albums. Yeah. Obviously, it's very different, and there were different times, different perspectives, but still, I feel like it is such an emblematic album for my generation, and, well, not only my generation, people a little bit older than me.
So much that it's very common to just play, like, the G note on a piano, and people will be like, My Chemical Romance?
It's Welcome to the Black Parade! So I do feel like it is very iconic album to a whole new generation, that at one point it will live up in the same, like, shelf.
Yeah. It's funny you should talk about that, Gina. Obviously, we'll talk about the song much more when we get to it. But, like, I think it's on TikTok, which, again, just shows you the way that we the way that we deal with music. That's probably the first time I've ever mentioned TikTok on my classic album.
But, really?
You know what I mean? But it shows you how music evolves, and the way that you listen to it and the way that we kind of celebrate it has changed. And there's certainly a video on TikTok going around with someone playing that G note, and then, like, people rushing in of a certain age because they know that's the start of the Black Parade. So I did that test with kind of people who were around my age, where I just kind of played that, obviously with no context, to see if they knew what it was that I was getting at. And everybody universally knew what that note meant and what was following.
Yeah, it definitely marked a generation. It's such an iconic song.
I remember that I used to play it to call you, like, downstairs. I would just play it on the piano, and Pa would just, like,
hey, welcome to the Black Parade.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Gerard, he'd been planning the Black Parade since 2002. And in his mind for quite some time, he'd actually thought this would be the end of My Chemical Romance, with that being kind of the final album, a working title of The Rise and Fall of My Chemical Romance. And he told NME in 2014, the end of Black Parade felt like a very natural ending. To go beyond that felt like betraying some sort of artistic command I had within myself, which I think is really interesting, because obviously we do know that Danger Days did come out in 2010, but you know, obviously they took a bit of a break. They've recently come back together. There's not really been much more studio work from this band since the Black Parade, and I wonder if that's a little bit of Gerard thinking, like, you know, in my head this was always the end, and it feels quite difficult to kind of move past that.
That must be like such a trip.
Mm-hmm. Like, especially, like, how do you plan your band's end?
That's like, but it takes a whole new different meaning if you see, like, that the last song on the album is called Famous Last Words, so it was definitely like,
and Cancer, the song, even though it talks about something, I remember, like, in their live concerts, they used it, you know, to say goodbye to their audience. It was, like, literally, so long and goodbye. Until next time.
That is insane. Yeah. Damn.
So, I mean, with the exception of some of their longtime fans, the Black Parade was met with this kind of critical acclaim upon its release. It was regarded as an instant classic, which I think is why it's continued to kind of build as the years have gone on. I think it does become more and more revered as the years go on. And shortly before its release, NME said the following about it. So this was like a week before the album was due to come out. They said, "The Black Parade is an ostentatious concept album come rock opera about death, and it's about to turn My Chemical Romance into the biggest band on the planet," which I tend to agree at that point it did. Before we dive in track by track, which we're about to, why do you think this album kind of resonated so quickly with so many people?
Oh my God. I'm trying to put it in the context of why I resonated with it. I feel like, again, it talks about topics that maybe you wouldn't expect other bands to do. And I feel like, especially at that age, like in middle school, you search for that type of understanding of certain things that people won't talk about. And I feel like it is such a good companion. Like, going through that journey alongside with someone, like with this character of hating themselves and their lives, and like, then dying and then coming back.
Having an opportunity to come back
and be better. I feel like it's very inspiring when you apply it to yourself. Like, I'm still alive and I can already make these changes. So I feel like we can all just connect with that feeling of giving a second chance.
And also, like, I agree with all that, but as an extra note, I think the music in and of itself, like, expresses so much without you needing to, like, understand the lyrics.
Yeah.
So it's just, like, it really gets into your system, your soul, the melody, the notes that they're playing, just kind of, you understand what's going on. Like, me as a Mexican, English is not my first language. So if I didn't read the lyrics at the first time and Gerard is just kind of, like, singing, but I could feel it right away. It's definitely just amazing.
So we'll dive in track by track. What I will say is, obviously, I think as I've gone through this, people have different, obviously with it being a rock opera and it kind of telling this story all the way through, I've noticed that people seem to have slightly different interpretations as to what's happening in different songs. So obviously I'll kind of explain kind of what the general consensus is, or perhaps what I think is happening in a song. But if you feel differently, absolutely, let me know if you think, well, actually, I think this is happening. You're full of rubbish, Mike, you know. go for it. So we'll start with the end. So we kick off with, obviously, with this track, as the patient lies in his hospital bed and he's breathing his last breaths, and Gerard sings, "Now come one, come all to this tragic affair, to set us up for what's to come." I mean, what are your thoughts on this as kind of, you know, the opening track on the album? Do you think it sets us up nicely for what's to come, or do you think there's no way to kind of to prepare us for what we're about to hear?
It's freaking genius. Yeah, that's what it is.
It's so good.
It's really amazing.
You start with
a narrator,
and like, and you start your album with a song that's called The End, and you're like, what is going on? But it's the end of this character's life. This character's in their deathbed, and you're kind of like walking through it as the song goes, and it's just very interesting to open up in that way, because it is very theatrical. You start with a narrator and they're kind of explaining what's going on,
and it's setting the scene of this journey that we're about
to go through.
Yes, with this character, because like, it's also like, it's actually telling the character to like, hey, this is your end, let's see how you like what you decide. Yeah. How you did, what you're going to go through.
Kerrang saved the song. Starting with the extinguishing bleeps of an ECG machine, the opener to the record is little more than a brief introduction to the Black Parade. But particularly as it starts things off with a death, it cleverly tees up the macabre big band theatrics to come. And I would totally agree with that. One thing it does, it certainly establishes there's like a drama. Like you said, there's this narrator, there's a death, there's, you know, it's already kind of the stakes are very high, and we're not really into kind of the first full song yet.
Exactly.
Definitely.
And actually, it matches up perfectly. Like, musically, the ending of The End bleeds into the next song, which is Death with an exclamation mark, because of course
you died. Well, the character died. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talk about the band. I'd said before about these kind of correlations, comparisons made with Pink Floyd's The Wall, obviously arguably the most famous rock opera of them all. And I think it's really evident here on The End. I hear a lot of similarities to In the Flesh, which opens up The Wall. In terms of almost kind of musically, I almost feel like it's like a nice little tribute there. Are you, any of you Pink Floyd fans? Have you heard that comparison, or is that something that you'd want to kind of check out for yourselves after this?
I think we will check it out for ourselves. We are very big Pink Floyd fans, especially because we grew up with that music. Our dad is a very big fan. But I think we've yet still to make that connection.
Yeah. Ooh, that's going to be a little homework. Yeah. Yes.
maybe I just want it to be there. I don't know. But I feel like I totally hear it anyway. But as you said, it bleeds really nicely into Dead, exclamation mark, which obviously that classic My Chemical Romance fair, the New York Times described the song saying, in the tune, a doctor delivers a terminal diagnosis with a wild mix of show tune bravado and stadium rock. Now, I think there's some great lyrics in this one, including, have you heard the news that you're dead? Which I just think is great. And if life isn't a joke, why are we laughing? Which just really kind of hit home with me for some reason. You know, do you think that those kind of lines, are they quite typical of the wit in My Chemical Romance lyrics? Is that quite standard fare for Gerard Way, would you say?
I feel like they have always come up with like, so the wittiest, most like
so cool smart
lyrics. I feel like that's a very big trademark of them. But especially in The Black Parade, I feel like there's so many of those really good one-liners that just leave you thinking like, whoa, okay.
What is this? Yeah. And it's just like, it actually, I love the exclamation mark on the of the title because it does leave you shocked. Like the whole song is just like, oh my god, okay, dead. We're dead. Got it. And also like musically, like structure wise, I think it's so innovative how that they did that all that whole outro of it with that new phrase, and they just like keep repeating it and repeating it and repeating it so that like it literally gets into your head and you're just like what's happening.
Which I imagine kind of if you were dying and there, you know, obviously we're getting into some pretty existential stuff here, aren't we, but like, you know, that moment where we do pass, I imagine if there is something on the other side, which I would like to think that there is, that's probably the exact feeling that you'll be feeling, kind of what's happening, what's going on. Scared, yeah, confused, freaked out, like, all of this stuff.
Yeah. And if you have like an entity actually like telling you, hey, you're dead and this is what is going to happen, I think it's even like more shocking. You're just like trying to not feel lost and you're like, that's the only reference that I have right now to what's going to happen to me. So I have to stick with it and see where it leads me.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I think that a lot of these songs, and, you know, we've already started to touch on this earlier, obviously they very much fit this concept of the patient and his time in the afterlife, but there's autobiographical elements here too. And obviously My Chemical Romance are not dead, but there's certainly some autobiographical elements kind of going on there. In the biography, Not the Life It Seems, Gerard explained that the song's about being dead and about people not liking you. We wanted to say, you may hate us, but we're still here. We wanted to say, here we are, and we're more daring and more defiant than ever. And that's kind of the message of the song, perhaps more from a band perspective rather than a conceptual perspective, that this is just, you know, it's the, you know, first full song on the album after this introduction. It's a statement of intent. It's like, here we are, take us or leave us.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense, because actually the like narrator is actually roasting the person who's dying also. It's like, and no one's going to miss you. Everyone hates you. So it's great that you're dead.
But I feel like it's really cool that they could also like apply these songs, because I feel like even when you're writing a concept album, there's also a little bit of personal feelings and experiences within these characters.
Yeah.
And like these stories and instances. So it's cool that this one applies in like such a like cool way, personal way.
Mm. And it's funny because, again, if I think about when this album came out, so I was very much, so 2006, you know, I was very much into kind of metal, hard rock. My social circle hated My Chemical Romance, hated
them. So my God.
The thought of that album coming out, obviously, it was like, oh, My Chemical Romance, whatever. But but I think what happened was, obviously, when this came out, as we've talked about, it was a huge hit. The album, certainly the single, March of the Black Parade, if not the album, both reached number one. So again, it's thinking about, you know, the band were aware there were these pockets of people that didn't like them, that, you know, that hated them, that wanted them to go away. But that just drove them even more to make this absolutely grand theatrical album that we're talking about today.
Oh, that's really cool, actually, like taking that knowledge that people may not like you and just making something even like better to like like to either make them like you or even like make them like you even less, but you're being cool, so it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the irony is, obviously, for me personally, to kind of stay with that story for a minute, is that all the influences that are on this album, you know, I love this album, I think it's great, and a lot of that is because of those influences, the things that I've loved since I was 4 or 5 years old, you know, talking mm-hmm. Queen, David Bowie, Pink Floyd, you know, they're all very much kind of in this album. So at the moment I heard it, I knew this was an album that I was going to enjoy, but, you know, maybe it took longer for me to discover it than it should have. But you know, interestingly, you know, talking about these kinds of influences and such, apparently the Bridge of Dead reminded the band of the Beatles' iconic Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band so much they just decided to chuck some tuba in there, so a little bit of brass. And I think that's what I love about it. You know, obviously there's some of these where we think, is this a tribute to this? Is this a tribute to that? We know for a fact there's definitely some in there. I just love these. They're almost kind of little Easter eggs of concept albums that have come before it, which I think's a great thing.
It is. Especially for like our newer generation, that sometimes we don't know all of these albums. Like you hear these influences and you become interested on what they could be, and then you just start discovering like so much music.
And they complement them like super well. Like we've tried. Well, I've had it on my mind to add brass to some of our songs.
It's
and
really
it's so
hard. It's really hard.
Because it can make it cheesy, but they did it like
in such a cool,
cool
manner.
Cool, epic way.
Let's move on to This Is How I Disappear. So again, what I think's great about this album is, as I said, that people, although there's certainly like a story and a concept, that people have their own interpretation as to how the story unfolds. And there's elements of that I think the band have never explicitly said what's kind of right or wrong. Honey Pop tell us that This Is How I Disappear seems to be about the patient's love life, describing his devotion to his wife, who appears again later on the album. Well, I'm interested in what your interpretation was of the song, and what does it bring up for you when you listen to it?
So I felt that This Is How I Disappear was a song of like the patient looking back on their like loved ones, like in general, people that were close to them. And just like being like, did I do my best? Was I not like good? And like having
and I
like
I can't
these,
believe that this is how
I disappear. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just like having these mixed emotions about it.
Yeah, I actually interpret it with the overbearing pressure of knowing that, okay, so I'm dying. And this is the first thing that comes to mind, that, okay, so what do I leave behind? Like, and going down that negative road that, oh my God, I'm leaving nothing. And
yeah, like it was horrible.
I was horrible. So, oh my God. And I love the word disappear, because it's not, he's not thinking of leaving something behind. He's literally erasing himself from the narrative, like completely.
And I think one thing Gerard has said about this song is that it was inspired by Harry Houdini's wife. So after Harry passed away, she tried to communicate with him through seances. So so I guess in my interpretation of this album, I'm with you, I think he's looking back at, he may have died yet, he may not, but it's a nice metaphor for, you know, even that idea of someone feeling, being out of reach, being unable to resolve something before we die.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the website, the Ward Melville Kaleidoscope, bit of a tongue twister, they note the importance of this song thematically on the album, saying this song carries an important message that loved ones will remember us after we die, which remains prevalent throughout the rest of the album. And I mean, we talked a little bit about the themes of the album early on. You know, do you think that is an important theme? Do you think that is something the Black Parade circles back to, this concept of, you know, we will be remembered when we die, you know, as it says in kind of the big single from the album, you know, we'll carry on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I feel
like that is the takeaway from the whole album, and just like, what are you gonna leave behind? I feel that's how it ends at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Like, are you gonna leave behind good stuff, or like things that you're not maybe that proud of? And it's just like finding a balance within.
And I think it's also teaching us that it's inevitable to leave something behind, either if it's good or bad. You don't disappear.
Yeah.
So we move on to The Sharpest Lives. So at this point, conceptually, again, I think you'd said this was your interpretation of the last song. I feel at this point, he's kind of reflecting on different parts of his life and kind of looking back, as I'm sure we all do when we get to that point. And I think with The Sharpest Lives, it's clear that the patient kind of lived life on the edge and maybe partied hard a little bit, did some things he shouldn't have done. Kerrang! Say of the song, one of a few songs on the Black Parade that has an obvious hangover from the post-hardcore menace of Three Cheers. The Sharpest Lives finds Gerard attempting to skewer a reckless life lived on the fringes of excess. It has some great kiss-offs, but other tracks on the album quite simply do it better. And I've got two questions coming from that, really. One of them, do you feel it would fit better on a kind of a previous album from the band? And two, you know, the implication is there that it's maybe a weaker track. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
What a fun fact! This is my favorite track on the album. It's such a good song. Yeah, like, lyrically, it's one of my favorite songs. I feel like it's really important to the story. Yeah. You're painting, like, you're getting context of, like, who this character was. Mm-hmm. They lived a reckless life. I feel like this is, like, a very youthful song. This is a character in their youth and just, like, everything that they did that maybe they're not that proud of. But it's part of them. So it really paints a picture on, like, how this character views themselves as on, like, what they had done before.
Actually, I think that's like such a key point in what you just said, like views themselves as, because I feel like The Sharpest Lives is like, they say that when you're dying, you kind of like replay your whole life.
Yeah.
You kind of see it through. So I feel like it's this patient just kind of like seeing themselves in a very like earlier version and just being like, because the song still has like this dark undertone of kind of chaos around it. Like, this desperation to kind of like, I think that the patient is trying to like understand his actions in some kind of weird way.
But I can't believe that people think that this song is a weak one. I love this song so much. It hypes me up. Like, this was my favorite song when I was in middle school. It's such a good song.
But I guess that's an interesting thing, isn't it? And it's like, obviously, I'm reading these things off kind of sort of like critiques and this, that, and the other, but it happens so often that people be like, oh, well, you know, maybe this is a weaker track, but then we're sitting there sometimes going, actually, no, not at all. Like, it's a really important track. It's a strong track.
It should, I feel like it's all about, like, personal taste, but I didn't know that that was, like, a thing.
Do you think, obviously, another implication in there is that they said that it, you know, to just read that a little bit again, it says that, you know, the track has an obvious hangover from the post-hardcore menace of Three Cheers. Do you think it would have fitted quite nicely on that album?
It could have.
It is a little bit more edgier.
I feel like The Sharpest Lives is too, like, polished to be. I feel like Three Cheers had, like, it's the same vibe of chaos, but lyrically, I just feel like it fits way more within this context.
It's like Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge was just, like, someone spraying like paint on a canvas, and this one was like, okay, I'm gonna plan my sprays on the canvas, but it's the same chaotic vibe, but it was just like planned.
I mean one of the things that Gerard, he's been really honest over the years around his own issues with addiction, mental health struggles, that kind of thing. Do you think this might be another example? Again, we've said lyrically, this, you know, you guys think this is a really important song in terms of the concept and the story. Do we think this is maybe another example as well, you know, maybe a kind of catharsis for Gerard to be able to kind of to sing about this?
It could be. I feel like this is also a song that is very easy to take away from the album and apply it to like normal, like, human struggle. So I feel like that could definitely be the case. Yeah, like, again, it was one of my favorite songs in middle school, and I just related to it so much. Like, it just like really struck a deep chord with me. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it could be a personal song.
So we move to the one song that surely everyone has heard from this album. I think to be fair, even if, like, if you're listening to this and you think, because obviously we do get some people who just, we get some listeners who pick and choose depending on the album, some who listen all the way through. If you think you haven't heard this song, go back, you will have done. And then I mean, welcome to the Black Parade. So first single off the album, it's come to represent a whole generation of music fans and arguably bands that have followed it, including yourselves. Before we dive too deeply into this one, what are your initial thoughts on Welcome to the Black Parade?
It's epic. It is
such a big the song changes a lot.
Yeah,
you go from one point to another to an end that feels very uplifting and inspiring. But when you put it in the context of the story, like, this person is dying.
Yeah.
Like, whoa, okay. But it was the first song I listened from this album, and it just like hit me in such a big way. I would cry at the end of this song. It just felt so epic and inspiring. And like, you know, I would literally, like, tears.
It does a really good job of painting the scene. Yeah. You know, you're like literally going through the parade with this person, and it's his death parade. You're just like going through it while he remembers stuff from his childhood. He decides to carry on. He's just like, no, I love it.
It's such a good song.
I mean, again, as you've been saying, within the context of the album, this is like the moment where the patient dies. I think everybody seems to be quite agreed on that. So death comes to him in the form of the Black Parade. And I've read that this stems from Gerard's belief that death comes for you in the form of your strongest memory. And for the patient, it was watching a parade with his father, which is obviously the lyrics at the start of the song. I feel like either of those, so the concept of death being a parade, full stop, or that it's his strongest memories, Gerard suggests, I think both of them are quite beautiful metaphors for death, I would say.
Yes, that is, like, I got chills when you said that. That is such a beautiful concept. Your strongest, like, cherished memory is the way that, like, you will pass on. That is such a nice concept. And it's really cool to put it in the context, like, of the album. And I feel like it definitely makes it, like, very clear. yes. within the song.
And okay, now I'm going to say an unpopular opinion.
Okay.
But get ready. Throughout the album, I never once thought that the patient actually died.
Ooh. Really?
Yep. I don't have
For me, this is the moment they die.
I don't think that they die in the album, actually. Because in death, they said you have 3 weeks to live. And he's going through this like limbo of recap of everything that went on in his life. And he actually wakes up from the coma and enjoys the 3 weeks and then dies.
Oh my God.
I actually don't think he dies.
Wow. I mean, that's a really good, like.
But you see, this is what's great about this album that says, so we just did, for example, we did a Frank Zappa album called Joe's Garage, which is another rock opera. The craziest thing you'll ever hear in your life, for anyone who's listening, it's absolutely insane. But it's very clear what's happening in that album. Right. This is happening, then this is happening. Even with The Wall, this is happening, this is happening. What's great about this album, again, is that, you know, I had made quite a definite statement there, didn't I? I was like, so we're all agreed that the patient dies here. But again, you're absolutely right. There's nothing to say that you're wrong. You know, that absolutely it could be that.
Ooh, but it's a nice thought. To think that they didn't die and then they come back and then they live those 3 weeks as best as they possibly can before dying. Mm-hmm. Like, that's
nice.
That's nice. Thank you. A redemption arc.
I mean, as I'd said, obviously in 2006, my social circle were not my Chem fans. But when the song came out, what struck me immediately, so I loved this song when it came out, and that's probably because of the massive Queen influence throughout the song.
Yeah, it's definitely there.
I mean, the guitar's particularly very Brian May-esque. There's this grand epic theater about it all. I mean, are you, obviously it sounds like you agree with the comparison, are you fans of Queen, or is that maybe?
Yes,
we're very big fans of Queen. Guitar arrangements in this song are super Queen-esque.
Yes.
Oh,
I can totally see it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. And just out of interest, because again, just looking at this album kind of through a different lens, really, like, obviously this is the album that best represents you as a band. It's the one that you kind of all kind of grown up with. Were you fans of Queen before this album, or did this album lead you to Queen?
Yes, definitely. So My Chemical Romance was one of like this album was one of the first albums I listened to, like I discovered on my own. But before that, we listened to whatever our parents were listening to. And my dad really loves Queen, really loves Queen. And so one of the things that we would do when we were children was like watch Queen concerts on our TV. So we were definitely big fans of Queen before we even knew My Chemical Romance. Mm.
So I guess when you heard this song, that link of instant, because I think anyone who...
Yeah, totally.
I mean, to make a more precise comparison, I've heard many call Welcome to the Black Parade the emo Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yes, definitely.
Just what I was thinking.
Yeah, there is a clear evolution and storytelling within the song. So totally, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And it actually does kind of like the same thing of changing throughout as the storyline
goes. Like musically.
So obviously we've talked about Kerrang a couple of times. They ranked all the songs on the album from kind of worst to best, and they placed Welcome to the Black Parade second. Obviously, I'll let you know which one was first when we get to it. But they ranked it second, saying there's something strange about this song appearing in the middle of the album. Those haunting and very, very famous opening piano notes, which can suck the air out of any room, always feel slightly abrupt and out of place, a bit like death, which I think is a really interesting observation because, yeah, I mean, being this is, you know, for some of us listening, this is the moment where the patient dies. Does it feel quite sudden in the context of the whole album for those iconic notes to come in?
Well, kind of. You're coming from The Sharpest Lives, which is a very hyper-chaotic song. And then just suddenly like, bing, ging, ging, ging. It is abrupt. It is an abrupt change.
And you know, the sound that they use, it's not only just a piano. It sounds like old. It sounds like this,
really haunting.
Yeah. So it's just like, yeah, you literally feel like death creeping up on you.
Yeah.
And this is a really interesting point here that, you know, and this is unbelievable. Like, I don't think I would have believed this unless I'd kind of read it in more than a couple of places. That Welcome to the Black Parade almost didn't make the album. So
what?
I know.
That's insane.
I know.
That's like the most emblematic song
it's
of my
even
generation.
The title of the album.
Like the Black Parade. That's insane.
Yeah. I think it was because Sir Gerard called it the hardest one to finish.
I can see that. I can totally see that.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I think when it finally all came together, I think, as you say, you know, it's emblematic of the album, isn't it? You know, it's here in the UK, it reached number one on the UK singles chart. It's okay. Obviously remained iconic for the last 16 years. VH1 called it the greatest song of the 2000s in 2011.
I could say, yes. Yes, I agree. Again, it marked my whole generation. We all, like, even people who don't like rock or don't listen to it,
they know this song.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think it's resonated as strongly as it has? And again, it was instant. It wasn't just like a song that grew 1 year. This was instant and it's kind of been here to stay ever since.
I don't know if it's because it feels so epic. It just like blew it out of the park. I think whoever just like listens to it is just like, they have no idea what's about to hit them.
Like it's a whole trip.
It's
like
a whole journey.
It's a whole journey and it really takes you like so many places emotionally. And again, even if you don't understand the context like of the story or you don't even speak English, like you feel it. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a wild ride of emotions. I don't know. It's just like such a good song.
Yeah. And I think that's because it is like by the end that you start, like you end the song and you're like, what the hell just happened? That you have to listen to it again. Yeah. To like kind of try understand what you went through.
Yeah.
One of the things I love about doing this podcast is I feel like people's enthusiasm for an album rubs off on me. So when people come on and they're really excited about this album and they talk about why they love it, that gives me a real excitement for the album too. And that's definitely the case in this case. I enjoy the album anyway, but hearing all three members of The Warning talk about this album and why they love it so much, I have been listening to it in a very different light to maybe I had been previously. And my conversation with them will continue in just a little bit. We'll continue to go track by track. I just wanted to read some of your thoughts that came through, obviously, when the news broke that the band were going to be appearing on the show. Jason Dudson said, "What an album to get inspiration from, and you can hear it in the sound of The Warning. Queen of the Murder Scene came very close to that level. A song like Famous Last Words is any upcoming rock musician's go-to, and for good reason. The Warning have that epicness still to be unleashed." And I would totally agree with that. As I've said right at the start, I think they're a band on the rise. I think they're a band that are going to be around for a long time. And you know what it is? They're so young. They've got their whole lives ahead of them, their whole careers ahead of them. It's exciting to kind of chat to them at this point and kind of see where they're going to go. Pablo Sartor simply said, "Viva The Warning." Fair enough. No, not much worth saying much more than that. I think that covers it. Adi Lealia said, "OMG, these are my two favourite bands." So My Chemical Romance, The Warning. I'd be interested to see how much bleed over there is there if there's a lot of My Chem fans who are maybe getting into The Warning. Or perhaps people who are listening to this episode. I'm going to be playing a track from The Warning in a moment. Perhaps they'll win over some new fans too. So we'll see. And then finally, a good friend of mine. So this is Bob from the Rock Guys podcast. Bob joined us at the very end of season 3 when I got some of my fellow podcasters from my favourite podcasts to come on and share their thoughts on Nirvana's Nevermind. I really liked it. I'll probably do it again for future anniversary episodes too. But Bob, clearly a big fan of The Warning. OMG, are you kidding me? This is so awesome. I love these guys. Oh man, now I'm excited. Without a doubt in my mind, I'm going to love this episode. Well, I hope you are, Bob. I hope you're enjoying it. And thank you very much to everyone who got excited. I always love to hear people's thoughts. You know, pop them in the comments of any posts. As I'd said earlier, send me messages, whatever you need to do. Just make sure that you're following us on social media. You subscribe to the podcast. Just make sure that you're not missing anything. Because, you know, some great guests and some great albums coming up over the coming months. And there's plenty to go back to too. So, you know, keep it here. But now, some music. And I like to think that My Classic Album celebrates the future of rock as well as the past. And today's a really good example of that. From their EP Mayday that was released last year, this is a song that the band specifically told me they felt had huge influence from My Chemical Romance. And when I asked about playing music on the show, this was immediately the song that they went to. This is The Warning with Animosity.
I've already collapsed, so I'll just drown my sorrows in a non-existent world. I don't know what is worse. The utter waste of time will be eroding of my mind. Alive means to be dead. A bullet to the head.
Funerals for all my friends, 'cause I can't last.
I mean, let's move on to I Don't Love You Now. So it's one of the few tracks not that wasn't written in the spooky, haunted Paramore mansion. This one was written on tour ahead of the Black Parade sessions. And Pitchfork praised the song, saying it's the band's first proper power ballad. And, well, they should definitely think about writing dozens more. So for a band not massively known for ballads, you know, what do you make of I Don't Love You? I do think there's maybe a couple of other tracks on this album that could maybe qualify as a ballad. And they're probably highlights as well, to be fair.
Yeah, so I really like I Don't Love You.
I Don't Love You is also one of my favorite songs. Yeah. I don't want any I Don't Love You slander on this podcast. It is such a good song.
You know, it is, even though it's such a good song, I absolutely love it. I personally can't attach it to this story.
Oh, yeah, I don't know where it falls into the story.
I don't know
as well.
Where it falls. Like, it's a cool kind of like looking back into the person's life in some kind of way, but I don't think,
you know what I think
if I
it
didn't
is?
Have it, I would still understand.
Yeah. Like, but okay, let's say you're saying that, okay. So let's say that this character dies, mm-hmm. right? But they don't die, they slip into this coma, like you said.
Yes, like a limbo.
And they're like reliving their whole lives. And I feel like every song after Welcome to the Black Parade is very telling of like memory. How this person was.
Yeah.
And things that really marked them in their lives.
So this could be like a falling out of love.
Yeah. Like a big part of their life. I don't know. I just really like it and I want it to make sense within the story.
A lot of the kind of connections I've made are from much older albums. And I don't know if this is a tribute, if it's pure coincidence, but certainly in kind of the chords, there's massive similarities here musically. And I think a little thematically as well to Coldplay's Yellow. Is that something that you've noticed kind of on this song?
Oh, wow.
I can see it.
I can definitely see it.
Yeah. Ish. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it leaves me with the same feeling as Yellow by mm-hmm. Coldplay does. So I can definitely see that.
Yeah.
I think this is a little bit different in the sense that it's a little bit more angsty because, yes, My Chemical Romance.
Just like
they're
kind of
like resenting that, oh my God, I don't love you the same as I did yesterday. It's just like, I think I have this feeling that they want to and they just don't.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know.
I mean, interestingly, this one's obviously quite a few big singles off this album. This I Don't Love You was the third single released in the UK and did pretty well over here. Big hit. Wasn't released over in the US. Do you think this is a song that might have done quite well if it was released as a single over in America?
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, in our defense, singles. I was four.
Fair.
But I don't know. Like, maybe, I don't know if it would have done. No, I feel like it was a good choice because I don't know what the singles were for the US, but I feel like a more energetic one would have been like a good option. And I feel like in the UK, I don't know. Like, I don't. I just feel like it makes sense.
It does make sense.
Yes, I don't know why, but it makes sense. Culturally, for
it's
me,
like
it makes sense.
The melodic is more like UK.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know, but I feel like it makes sense.
Yeah. So the tempo picks up again for House of Wolves. So the patient's contemplating the sinful life he lived and this resignation in this song that he's going to go to hell, essentially. So, I mean, again, obviously and I think what I like about the song again, particularly as we get deeper in, I feel the tempo shifts around so much. We jump around so much. Yeah. What do you make of this song? I mean, obviously, I think I'll talk a little bit more about kind of some stuff that Gerard said about it. But what do you make of House of Wolves?
House of Wolves. I think I'm going to say this about every single song, but it was one of my favorites. Like, I really liked it. I remember just saying, like, screaming at the top of my lungs that S-I-N-I-S-I-N. Like, it is such a catchy song. It just feels very youthful and reckless and chaotic. But I feel like these changes of pace that go throughout the whole album, especially after, like, Welcome to the Black Parade, I feel like it signifies as if, I'm trying to think of the name of this thing, but you know, and the older times when they would take pictures, they had like this projector and it would change like, I don't know what it's called, but it's a round thing. It's not from my times at all. Like, I don't know what it's called.
But yeah, like you end one movie and start the next
one. Yeah, just like, and I feel like these changes of pace are like this person just like watching and flashing images, everything that they did. And there is supposed to be like this very drastic parts, like,
you
it's
know,
the whole life.
And I think that this song is kind of like the recognition of their behavior. Like, they were super okay with how they were acting, that they along the way grew to accept it and like teach it to everyone else, you know, like, you know, the thing about, oh, I forgot the next word. But yeah, it's like they're kind of like preaching their way of life in a way. And, you know, OK, just like small fun fact, every single song on this album has been my favorite at one point or another, except this one.
What? I really like this song.
I
felt attacked personally by that statement.
It's true, though. All of them have been my favorite except that one. I don't know why.
It's a good song.
It is a great song. I agree. But, like, I don't know.
Interestingly, the deluxe version of the album has some bits where they kind of talk about kind of the inspiration for the song and such. And they say on there that this could potentially be the patient's glimpse into hell, which was imagined as a fiery jazz club filled with demons, wolves, and sinners.
That makes so much sense. And that is the vibe. You get that. You listen to the song and you can see that. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. I agree with that.
Yeah. There's this really kind of jazzy influence in the drums. I think obviously it's not a jazz song, yeah, but there's definitely kind of elements of that.
Definitely. It's there.
Yeah, I can see that too. You're just like, look, this is something that may be for you.
Yeah.
Like, damn. Yeah.
It's nice.
So we move on. So I think the next couple of songs particularly are very, very important ones on the album. And we'll start with Cancer. So this was apparently written in just 8 minutes, which blows my mind.
Oh, what? Minutes.
So Cancer.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So Cancer once again sees the patient in that reflective mode. And with a name like that, I mean, the word, it's funny. I work in mental health when I don't do this podcast. And I was at some training last month and it was about working with patients who've been diagnosed with cancer. And we were talking about how emotive that word is, just to say the word, it can be really difficult to say, you know. So to name a song Cancer, you know, about as emotive and heart-wrenching as one would expect, but a firm favorite with My Chemical Romance fans. Yeah. Obviously, I know that you've kind of, there's been different songs that you've picked out as your favorites throughout so far. Would anyone single out Cancer as one of their favorites?
Me, yes, as well. Yeah. But I would,
because it, you, like, understand it right away.
Every time I listen to the song, it doesn't matter how many times I've listened to it, I get chills and I want to cry. It is such an emotive song, and like there's so much emotion in the performance of the actual song, and those bittersweet chords, because they're not inherently sad chords, but they feel so
frustrated,
so sad. And it's just, I feel it, I think this is the saddest song My Chemical Romance has ever written. And it is devastating.
I love that it's a sad song with an angry connotation. You know, they're like, I can't believe that this is what I
have.
Yeah, what I am right now. And they, like, literally throughout the whole lyrics, you are just kind of like really immerse into their experience, even though you're
and
not.
When it ends saying, but the hardest part of this is leaving you, I like turn into a sobbing puddle. Like, that is such a sad thing.
It is, but it's so well done.
And obviously, I know you were saying it, certainly kind of not just on the album, but perhaps the saddest ever My Chemical Romance.
Yes.
I'm sure I read somewhere that was actually his aim, that he was like, I want to write the darkest, most sad song that I've ever written.
Well, mission accomplished.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've discussed throughout our chat kind of these different influences and homages throughout the Black Parade. Many see Cancer as a very Beatles-esque track.
I can see that, yes.
What is it about the track that you think kind of warrants that comparison?
Ooh. I actually don't know.
I feel like the way it grows,
yeah,
like it starts on the piano and then it starts growing into something else.
It's kind of like this is just at the top of my head, but I just thought of like Hey Jude.
So how it starts somewhere, yeah, and then it, yeah,
so it's just,
I can
like
see
piano
that
and vocal, and it just like keeps growing and growing and growing and growing, but without adding like too much to it.
Yeah,
like, and it's simple in a Beatles way. If that makes
sense.
It's really interesting you should talk about Hey Jude, because there was, as I was doing my research, there's a really cool article from the New York Times where they go through all the tracks on this album and they talk about songs that have come before that may have inspired it, songs that have come after that were inspired by it. And the Beatles song it picks out is Hey Jude. So that's really interesting.
Yay!
Yeah.
Yay.
I mean, the song received a new lease of life in 2016 when 21 Pilots released their own cover.
Yes. That's yes. How I... Like, I remember the 21 Pilots version. I really liked it. I remember a lot of people, like, heavily disliked it.
Yeah.
It's a very different version, but I also listened to it a lot.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Gerard got his seal of approval, telling Pop Buzz there's a bit of rejiggling of parts, and I was like, wow, this almost sounds like a remix, but it's a cover by way of this kind of a rearrangement, and I was really impressed with it. And, you know, I'm not someone who's listened to much 21 Pilots, but I did enjoy their version of it. You know, I think I prefer the original, but...
My Chemical Romance was like sad and frustrated.
Yeah, you could feel anger and desperation.
In 21 Pilots, it was just pure sadness and kind of like
letting go. Like
letting go. Yeah, giving up on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So we'll move on to one of my favorite tracks on the album. And in what website Honey Pop calls one of their most memorable moments, it's Mama. So Mama introduces this character, Mother War, who is voiced by none other than Liza Minnelli.
I remember.
It's crazy. Would you feel, is this the moment where the album's creativity reaches its peak, would you say?
Yes, it is such a theatrical song.
That intro, you're just like, what the hell is going to happen?
The ending of the song is my favorite part.
Yeah. Like, the fiddle that comes in is just like, what?
I really like the ending. I feel it's just like, wow.
And it also has an accordion, I think.
It's such a like dynamic song. Like there's so many things in it. The lyrics, I love it. And I feel like it really like continues painting this character that we see and like their past and what they've been through.
You know that he was a soldier.
Yeah. And like there's just so many layers to the song. But I love it. Again, I'm saying that every song is my favorite. But... this one specific, I'm saying that about every single song, but it's so good.
But to be fair, that's why it's your classic album. They can all be your favorite, so that's all good, isn't it?
Exactly. Thank you.
All good. I mean, that premise of bringing in Liza Minnelli, so that was something, maybe a joke's not the way of putting it, but something the band could kind of throw it about, being like, oh, well, we could get Liza Minnelli in, which led to disbelief when producer Rob Cavallo actually made it happen with Liza recording her vocals remotely.
I remember reading about that. Yes. They were very happy about it. And
Gerard said of her performance in 2011, he said, everything in there was her. Nobody told her to do anything. It was really cool. What do you make of her performance here? You know, what do you feel that Liza Minnelli adds to the track? It's a perfect but odd pairing, isn't it?
It's like the cherry on top. Like, it makes the song so believable and, like so real. Like, there is this entity that is, like, saying this, and like it just makes everything like very concreto, like a concrete, like it's there, that's what happened, and it adds such a like theatrical element to it. You feel like you're watching like a musical in that
part.
The
performance was so good. Yeah. I can't believe that they didn't tell her anything. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So I mean, Mama was one of the favorite tracks of producer Rob Cavallo as well, and a major reason why he wanted in on the project. So he said, I just love the sound of that song so much. I thought it was so haunting, dark and scary. It had this essence of World War II coming over it too. I just stood up in the middle of the performance and started pumping a fist in the air. I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever heard. I think they liked my enthusiasm. Do you think, obviously the band, of course, will be invested in the song. It's clear that Liza's invested in the song. Rob's clearly invested in the song. Do you think that all kind of comes through, that enthusiasm comes through on Mama?
Yes.
Definitely.
It sounds funny to say it, but when we're working on certain songs and we all have a favorite, like us, our producer, everyone on our team, like there is a certain like excitement to work on these songs. Mm-hmm. So at the end, like in the end product, you can always sometimes feel it.
You can sense the energy that went through this. No, one of my favorite things about this song is like the soldier's chants. It's just like
at the end, after all.
Like that, like, oh my
again,
God.
That ending. It's so dramatic.
The whole lyrics of that part. The whole song. But like that part.
But also Gerard's performance, like vocally. Yeah. Like what? That's insane. Like as a singer, like to be able to do that and like transmit so much in like such different ways depending on the parts of the song, that's like kudos to him. That's insane.
I feel like he's crying like the whole time.
So Rob also had some chilling words about recording Mama at the Paramore. So this is where we're going to get into some more of the kind of the stuff that happened there. Telling biographer Tom Bryant, he said, the demo tapes are really crazy to listen to. You can almost hear the haunted house in the background. You can almost see the ghosts flying around the room when we recorded those songs, especially Mama. when we played that at Paramore, we were in a giant room with 40-foot high ceilings and big windows overlooking Los Angeles, and it was cold. It felt like the dead of winter, and we're not used to being cold in Los Angeles. I would wear a ski jacket in that house because the heat didn't get in there. It was freezing. Thinking about it, why did we subject ourselves to that torture? And I read that and I thought, I bet Liza Minnelli was probably really glad that she recorded her vocals remotely, thinking that's what was going on inside.
That must have been so scary. That's like, again, so scary. I can't imagine being in that situation.
Yeah, listening to that song in that room, I would be freaked out. I was like, I feel like someone's behind me.
But if I was a ghost, I would be like, even Mama like had the ghosts enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Like, everyone was excited about that song.
Yeah. It's definitely a highlight. It's definitely a highlight. But let's talk about sleep. So we mentioned this a little bit earlier. More Tales from the Paramore, because again, we'd said obviously there was certainly a link here early on.
Yeah.
And sleep was a product of Gerard's experiences in the Haunted Mansion. So we talked about those night terrors that he'd had earlier throughout his stay, which inspired the lyrics to this song. I think you can hear kind of sort of like fuzzy recordings on a dictaphone.
Yeah, he speaks about it in the beginning, like with those words, night terrors. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And from what I can gather is that he kept that dictaphone by his bed while he was trying to kind of overcome these night terrors, I guess. What are your thoughts on sleep? Yeah, I think the recordings particularly really capture that claustrophobic nature. I mean, I've never experienced it myself, thankfully. But, you know, what are your thoughts on the song?
I freaking love it.
It's one of my favorite songs.
Yeah, no, really. That's surprising. No, but okay, so actually my interpretation of this song, I think it's a little bit different for me. Like, I imagined the patient kind of like wanting to get rid of seeing his whole life. He was just suffering, going through everything again, and he didn't want to. He just, you know, he was kind of like giving up on it a little bit and just wanting to sleep. Like, let me just stay here. That's it. I don't want it anymore.
Sleep lyrically is one of my favorite songs on the album. And also how the song grows at the end. Again, what you said, like that claustrophobic. Oh, I can't say that word.
Claustrophobic.
Feeling at the end. Like, there's just so much going on. And you can hear somebody screaming at the end. And the being final line. That part. It's insane. That whole ending. I feel like it captures perfectly, like, having those nightmares and having that struggle.
Having that, like, sleep, which is meant to be good and just to rest, being, like, corrupted in some sort of way.
I mean, talking about the song, Gerard told Travis Mills for Apple Music One that Sleep's his favorite alongside Mama to play live from the album.
It must be very fun. Yes.
Yeah. He said it just has a completely nuclear guitar sound. It's just completely brutal, a wall of brutality. I like the subject, and it's really just a great one to play live. You could really lose yourself in it and feel it. You know, you were saying that obviously it sounded like you clicked with that quite quickly. Why do you think it would translate well in a live setting?
Oh, well, songs that you really enjoy live are usually the chaotic ones.
Yeah.
Where there's like so much going on and they're high-paced and energetic and you can just like really lose yourself in there. And sometimes, like with some of our songs, there are songs that I wasn't the biggest fan of when we really recorded them and released them, but playing them live,
it's really different.
It's a very different experience. And so I can totally get that
vocally. I think for Gerard must have been super fun because he can really just like let go. And that every time that he says sleep, literally. Yeah.
I know there's been a couple of times where if we've brought some criticism in, so the Kerrang has some criticism for sleep. If we think about, I mean, I said there was the ranking. I think that with the exception of the bonus track, which we'll talk about at the end, Kerrang put sleep dead last in their kind of ranking.
No!
Oh my God.
So I'll read what they said, because I'd love to know your thoughts on it. So they said the fuzzy tape recordings muttering about being strangled that appear throughout sleep were apparently inspired by night terrors that Gerard suffered while the band stayed at the Paramore Mansion, which obviously we'd said. That's about as interesting as this song gets, though, as its epic setup shoots for the moon but doesn't quite clear the first row of houses. Would you say that's quite harsh criticism for the song?
I feel personally attacked by that statement.
I want to slap someone.
Wow, no.
No, not at all.
No, I feel like it's such an interesting song that like turns into something like very raw and emotional at the end. It's such a journey.
Especially since I think it's something that we can all connect to. We've all had nightmares. We've all been, you know, well, I think so.
Yeah, just I think it would be really
waking
weird
up in the middle of the night, just like sweating, like and be like, sweat, what happened?
So I feel like it's, and it can also translate into like do so many things. So I feel that no. Sleep wouldn't beat that last. That is such a good song.
I think if there's one thing I've learned from doing this podcast is that kind of what critics often think is a weak song and what kind of music lovers generally think is a weak song are probably two very different things. Let's move on to another one of the big singles from the album, Teenagers.
Teenagers.
I think this is the first song I heard.
I think that's, yeah.
You want to know something that's really funny? When I downloaded Spotify for the first time, mm-hmm. I only had two songs saved, and one of them was Teenagers by My Chemical Romance. Before I even knew who they were, this was a song that I already loved. So yes, I'm a big fan of this song.
So Gerard told the New York Times that the inspiration for Teenagers came from being on the subway in a carriage full of high schoolers. He said that was the first time I felt old. I was nervous and I was a target. I felt like I'd become a parent figure or part of the problem. Now this for me, when we're talking about, you know, this isn't a criticism of the song by any means. Mm-hmm. This is the only track that I struggled to fit into the narrative of the story.
Likewise, this is correct. Yes, that I don't know how it fits. I always try to put it in the context of, oh, the character is looking at their life and this was, he was just really scared of teenagers. But I don't know how it makes sense within the album as well.
I mean, interestingly, this is another track that nearly didn't make the album. So Gerard told NME, he says, that song almost didn't fit on the record, but it's a topic that's so important to our culture. It's about a really big problem in America where kids are killing kids. The only thing I learned in high school is that people are very violent and territorial. And perhaps that's the answer. Perhaps maybe it doesn't fit into the story, but you just felt it was an important song to put on the album.
I feel like that definitely happens with concept albums sometimes. You create music at a certain time in your life where you're thinking or experiencing certain things. And then you try your best to fit it in the album, and sometimes it doesn't fit. But I'm so glad that they still released it, though. Again, this is like, I feel like apart from the Welcome to the Black Parade, this is also a song of like our generation. Mm-hmm. Teenagers like just got like a super big trend on TikTok recently, like last year. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and I think it's very recognizable,
very relatable. Because teenagers like, really don't care.
Like even as a teenager, I could relate to being scared of teenagers. Yeah. So
Which I think is another way of looking at it, isn't it? So obviously, Gerard is like, obviously, when My Chemical Romance, you know, he started this band and, you know, he'll have felt like, you know, one of the kids. And then obviously he's got to a certain point and he's like, oh, well, actually, and it happens to us all. We're like, oh, well, hang on. They're the kids. You know, I'm now on the other side of this. So it's interesting to hear from your perspective when you're saying, you know, even as a teenager, and again, thinking back, I totally agree. Even as a teenager, you're scared of teenagers because.
Yeah. That must be like such a like interesting like process to go through. Mm-hmm. Like I can't imagine it with us because I mean, we started playing when we were really young and we started this band when we were like literal children, like actually releasing music. So I can't imagine when that point, like when we will get to that point, like, oh my God, we're not young anymore. Like we're not.
We're like, so used to making like music for the young.
Yeah, like now it's gonna be like, am I supposed to like not be making music for a younger audience? Like that's insane. That's really crazy.
I mean, obviously there was a quote there from NME. The magazine again had high praise for Teenagers when it was released as a single. So they said at the time, some bands go out of their way to do a song with a sound they're never bound to do, then release it as a single. They usually fail. My Chemical Romance tried a substantially different sound for this song and it paid off. The message is simple, the chorus is catchy, and Ray Toro's solo joins the chorus and bridge together so smoothly. Do you think it was a bit of a change in direction for them? I know I've said this, obviously this album's a lot more polished than what's come before.
Yeah, yes. It is. Like, it's definitely like a standout in the album. Like, I think it's the only one that has a little bit more of like a cheery vibe. Like, it's not melodramatic.
Yeah, it's not that. It's not theatrical.
Yeah, like when I listened to the album for the first time and then Teenagers started playing, I couldn't believe that the song was part of the same album.
Right.
Like, really that I was different. Listening. Yeah, it's really different.
It does sound My Chemical Romance, but
within like a different context. Yeah. I don't know. It's still a bop though. I love it.
So we'll move on to Disenchanted. So quite a wistful, reflective track after what we've just heard. Disenchanted brings us back to the story of the patient. Yes. Honeypop says, Disenchanted might just be the prettiest track on the Black Parade, blending a more mellow acoustic guitar with a frustrated chorus. It describes life's up and downs, especially as the patient nears his dying day, so the contrast between the verses and chorus makes the back and forth nature more apparent. And I'd never thought of it like that. But do you think the music does reflect that, that if he's kind of looking back on his life, as he has done throughout the album, the ups, the downs, the good, the bad, Disenchanted, a good musical interpretation of that?
It feels very nostalgic, like the whole song. And I love that it starts and it ends like the same way. Kind of like, and again, it builds up so much that I love that at the ending they're just like playing the same thing over and over again, and they just like keep taking away elements of, you know, the
I love
instruments,
this
and it just kind of like fades away, like if it's like literally dying. So I absolutely love it.
And I feel like this is like a very big turning point in this story, because now they're saying like, will it matter after I'm gone? Like, what did I do? This is what I lived through. And I feel like they're disenchanted with their lives. Like they're unsatisfied with what they did, like what this character did. And I feel like that is the turning point in like perspective, from being like, oh my God, my life sucked and this, all of this happened. I'm very negative, to like, oh my God, like what did I do? And what can I do with what I have left? I feel like this is the turning point.
And I think it's quite ironic that, you know, the big hook in the chorus is just a sad song with nothing to say.
Yeah.
And obviously we've established this song seems like it has quite a lot to say.
Yes.
I mean, one of the first songs written for the album, apparently, Disenchanted, first came to life on the previous tour with a working title of Shut Up and Play. Loudwire stated that this track barely made the final cut for the album, but bassist Mighty Way ultimately saved it from its demise. I've read somewhere, and I hope to God this is true, that he would, when the rest of the band were asleep, he would kind of go up to them and whisper Disenchanted in their ears to try.
I have also heard about that. I also heard about that. I hope it is true.
I really do.
That's really funny.
Do you think it would have been a lesser album? Like, say if he hadn't got his way, do you think it would have been a lesser album without this track on here? I know you've said you feel like it's a bit of a turning point.
I feel like it is such an important part of the album.
Yeah, it is a very important. I don't think it will be a lesser album because the songs are so great. But
I feel like it definitely adds so much to it.
Yeah.
It was one of my favorite songs at one point as well. Like, I connected very deeply with it. I really love it.
So then we'll move on to, so obviously, this is where, obviously, with newer albums, we often have bonus tracks and such, but certainly on vinyl, a lot of editions of the album, it closes with Famous Last Words. There is also a bonus track called Blood, which we'll talk about too. Mm-hmm. But essentially, in terms of the main album, it closes with Famous Last Words. So another song inspired by their time at the Paramore. In many ways, Famous Last Words, for me, and I'll explain why as we go on, Famous Last Words is almost the story of their time producing this album. I mean, what are your thoughts on Famous Last Words? Because I know obviously for many, I know I'd said about that Kerrang ranking, this was the song that they ranked number one, was Famous Last Words.
I could see that.
Yeah,
I could
actually,
totally see
I was
that.
Just about to say that. Let me guess, this was going to be the number one song.
It is such an incredible song, and it leaves with such a nice message, like a very hopeful tone after like such a big album talking about death and everything that you did wrong in your life, and like ending with I am not afraid to keep on living. Like wow, what a, like, that is character development. right there.
Yeah. And you know, using the word afraid, I think is like so key in this song, because like, yeah, sometimes what we don't do in our lives is because we're afraid to do it. So it's now like, I'm not afraid to change my ways and just keep on living, and just like, or it says to walk this world alone, like he can enjoy it for himself, even though like he knows that what he has done to this point has led him, you know, to be that way. But like, still, it's just so,
oh my God. It's such an inspiring song. Like, I really love it.
And it says to be like unafraid, asleep or dead or whatever he is. He's just like choosing not to be afraid anymore.
Obviously, we talked a little bit about how Mighty struggled with his mental health quite significantly during production of the album. And he ended up leaving the Paramore, I think, and the band temporarily, as he was quite severely depressed. I've quoted quite a bit from this interview with Apple Music One, but Gerard kind of talked a little bit about that time. He said, when we were at the Paramore in pre-production, basically still writing things, they got kind of dark. I know that Mighty struggled with some health issues. the place, we liked it, but it had this weird energy that it was kind of haunted. Things would occasionally kind of get dark. One night, I'm up really late because sometimes we'd work well into the morning, and I was with Ray, and I think he was kind of playing something. And basically, this song started to kind of take shape, or at least emerge, and then we all started playing it together. So again, this song's very much a product of their kind of their trials and tribulations, kind of everything that happened in this mansion.
Of that energy, that's
really incredible. That the takeaway was like, if the takeaway, the whole experience is something like what is said within the song, like that's very incredible.
Yeah. And in that same interview, Gerard identified a nod to Judas Priest on Famous Last Words, saying, I remember thinking that I wanted those verses to feel very Judas Priest. I kind of wanted this old school driving metal sound, like almost the early days of metal, just to have that kind of swagger that Judas Priest has. But it was written at a dark time, and I think that's why there's so much emotion in that song. Do you think they succeeded? Is there a Judas Priest kind of feel to Famous Last Words?
I don't think I'm qualified to give that.
That verdict.
I don't. But does it, in your opinion?
I think it does. And I think, to be fair as well, I think sometimes when an artist is saying something, we've got to, you know, you've got to take that on, haven't you? But, you know, as someone, I mean, I'm a Judas Priest fan, and I can definitely see where he's coming from there. That, like you say, that kind of old school metal sound is definitely present on this one.
That's nice.
Yeah, that's great.
So, I mean, in the context of our journey with the patient, and you've been talking a bit about this already, you know, that Kaleidoscope News, they theorized that on the album's Defiant final track, the patient finally acknowledges that while life is hard, it's worth living. And then it takes courage to go on and go home at the end of the day. The hopeful ending leaves the fate of the patient up for debate, which is exactly what we were talking about earlier. Did he fight back to life, or accept his realizations and die peacefully with the track as his defiant shout into the void? So I think this is a good opportunity just to kind of check in with everyone. What do we believe the patient's fate was?
Wow. I think it's nicer to believe that he had, like, he now has these 3 weeks to continue living as best as he possibly can and then just pass on peacefully. But also, I feel like it would be, like, very My Chemical Romance-y and very dramatic that he is dead.
Yeah.
And that he realized this as he was dying. Like, he said peace with it, like a lesson
to everyone who will, like, because everyone will go through that one day.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then on some editions, obviously, I'm going to ask you in a little bit what you think the definitive end of the album is. But on some editions of The Black Parade, there is a bonus track that's called Blood. So it's a short little track. It's about a minute or so long, cheeky little cabaret number. You know, is it an integral part of the album, or is it just a nice little bonus that we get kind of alongside?
Okay, so with Blood, I don't feel like it's an integral part of the album, but with Blood, I feel Blood really supports the idea that the patient is alive. And that they're, like,
giving blood.
That, like, he's in the hospital, but he's happy. Like, he's alive. He's there. Yeah.
He's just like, I'm gonna do this.
Blood, gallons of the stuff. Blood. Yeah. Yay.
But you know how I've always imagined it, though? It's like the ending credits of a movie.
You just kind of hit the little jack.
So you're just like, okay, yay.
I mean, obviously, what I tend to ask at this point is, I always say, you know, whatever the final track is, how does it end the album for you? What do we think is that definitive end to the album? Like, is it Famous Last Words, or is it, does it have to be Blood in order to feel kind of the whole journey?
Oh, what is it called? Is it an epilogue? So I feel like Blood is the epilogue.
Yeah.
So
you don't need it, but it makes...
But it's a satisfying feeling. Like, okay, no, I'm on board with the patient is alive theory.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
I'll be there. Yes.
Woohoo. That's what's great about this, though. I think we've dug so deep into it now that we're all kind of changing our minds. I think it's awesome. So with the release of The Black Parade, My Chemical Romance went from emo darlings of the age to an important band who would go on to influence a whole generation of bands that followed, not least due to this album. So I've read a few quotes from this article by Honey Pop, and I have one more, which I think sums up the album's impact perfectly over the last 16 years. There's a reason that fans often say The Black Parade is My Chemical Romance's best album. Its intricate storyline, powerful energies, and descriptive lyrics make it an unforgettable staple of the 2000s rock scene. It's gone on to inspire newer artists like New Year's Day, Sleeping With Sirens, and even Post Malone. The Black Parade pushed My Chemical Romance in a new direction of fame and more acclaim, while letting them stay true to their sound and focus on stories. It highlights what the band does best, creating an immersive universe of lyrics and storytelling, while also drawing from feelings that are very real and present in our world. So with all that in mind, why do you think The Black Grid has stood and will continue to stand the test of time?
I agree with that statement.
It's very
so
hard
much.
To top that statement.
Yeah. I agree. It tells a very compelling story, but it also has like this very human and real touch to it that you can relate to it, even though, and you feel very like accompanied mm-hmm. with the album and understood, if that makes any sense.
Even though it's a very, you know, it's a storyline and it follows the story, still, I think it's vague enough for each track to have their own life and be applied to each and every person who listens to it in a different way. So I think that's very special.
And apart from story, like story wise, musically, it is such an incredible album.
I hate
it. And I feel like it will stand the test of time because it's just so good. It is really good. And I feel like just as like how it has inspired us and many other artists, mm-hmm. it will continue to inspire many more generations to come, hopefully.
And finally, why is The Black Parade your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Ooh, okay. Check it out because we say so. No, I'm kidding. No.
Yeah.
So why is it our classic album? For me, I feel like it really opened up a window with what I could personally do with songwriting and opened so many new possibilities of like storytelling and how to express feelings. And lyric wise, I just feel like there was so many new things within this album for me that I had never heard before. And musically also as well, how to present that energy and those feelings, like just with music alone.
Yeah, and for me, it's very special because it doesn't matter at which point I listen to it. I've like throughout the years, I always find like something new to even listen to or think about. Like it will always, I think, expand my mind to
and
other places.
You know what? I feel like it withstands the test of time just with the fact that I discovered it when I was in middle school. I'm a very different person now than who I was in middle school. And I feel like I've changed so much, but I can still listen to this album mm-hmm. and still feel very emotionally attached to it, but in a different way.
And it doesn't feel like it's from 2000.
Yeah, it's not like, oh, it was from my middle school phase and that's where it will stay. No, like, no.
Yeah. That's not why we like it.
Exactly. It grows with you. Thank you. Exactly.
Well, guys, thank you so much for joining me. It's been awesome chatting about this album with you. Obviously, it's clear how much of an impact it's had on kind of you as a family, as a band, all of that, which is amazing. I know, obviously, you know, as we hopefully creep out of COVID times, you know, obviously I imagine that you guys will be kind of chomping at the bit to get back out there and recording and touring.
Yes.
Yeah. What are your plans for 2022?
Okay. So we recently had to postpone a tour, yes. But we're hoping that for the next couple of months and weeks, we will be able to figure out when we can start touring again. And honestly, we're just waiting for it to be safe and healthy for everybody.
Yeah.
We want to share our music in the safest way possible.
We just released new music, actually.
Yes, we just released our new EP called Mayday, and which is, it's 6 songs of 12 songs that we recorded with David Bendith and 2020. And we're just very excited to be releasing more new music and sharing it with people and hopefully being able to play live soon.
Yeah. Any plans to get to the UK or?
Oh, of course. We have to. We actually have like, how do you say a compromiso?
We did a Kickstarter campaign and they actually like bought a VIP concert for the UK. So
we nice. Technically have to go.
Yes,
to
whenever
it's possible. We don't know when.
We don't know
hopefully
when.
Hopefully soon.
But hopefully very soon. If we're down there, we'll let you know.
So there you have it. It's an album that takes you on a hell of a journey, you know, as concept albums and rock operas do. But I think, you know, it's interesting. I think that My Chemical Romance are a band that, you know, perhaps at the time were maybe a little underrated, a little pushed to the side. I think The Black Parade was the album that made people sit up and take notice. And it certainly is. It's the album that's become their legacy over the last 16 years. So thank you very much to Ali, Danny and Pau of The Warning for joining me. And thanks for choosing The Black Parade. That'll do it for another episode of My Classic Album. We're back in the swing. It's fantastic. And in a week's time, you're not going to have to wait very long for episode 3. As I'd said, I'm going to be joined by Jack J. Hutchinson to chat about his chosen classic album, After the Gold Rush by Neil Young. So yeah, keep it here. Next Tuesday, here, My Classic Album, Neil Young, Jack J. Hutchinson, the works. Hope you enjoy it. See you soon. Cheers.